There is a fierce defining and a narrow defining of who my neighbor is, because we as white evangelicals want to be really clear whom we're responsible for and whom we're not responsible for.
On March 25th, 2018, women, men, and children from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador began walking north towards the U.S. border. As weeks passed, their numbers grew, and their story began to move toward the spotlight of major American news sources. Of course, the tint of that light varied in shade depending on its source. For instance, the city administration warned of the potential threat of this group of people should they reach San Diego, even suggesting at one point that there might be, and this is a quote from the president's tweets, unknown Middle Easterners among the group, making it a kind of Trojan horse for more recognizable international threats. Well, on Sunday afternoon, November 25th, what had come to be known as the migrant caravan finally began to reach and cross the southern border of the U.S., just north of Tijuana, Mexico. And as they reached the doorstep of America, the various and opposing narratives surrounding them rose to a kind of peak volume. And is so often the case, somewhat quietly, under the buzz, the dust, and the noise, thoughtful, caring women and men went about the business of meeting this moment and the real people in it, face to face and eye to eye. One of those people is my guest, Jer Swigert. His work with the Global Emergent Project approaches and addresses many of the same questions the migrant caravan story raised among those who paid attention. Not just questions of the tension between law and human good, but more eternal questions like, what does it mean to be a neighbor? Who is my neighbor? And how do I live up to the word neighbor once I'm convinced and convicted of it? Check it out. How's Bend?
It's good, man.
Are you settled? Are you done? You're done moving? You're in Bend? You're going to die there?
Oh, gosh. Who knows where I'm going to die? I'll probably die in like some foreign.
Let's start there. Let's start there, Jer. Where do you see yourself dying?
Yeah, I'll probably die in a foreign prison somewhere. because I was an Enneagram 8 at the wrong moment and said something too bluntly, and
yeah,
you know,
right?
a foreign dignitary wants my head. But
it's a hell of an ending, so you know, why not?
It'll make for an epic story.
It will make for an epic story.
No, yeah, we're in Bend. It's amazing. Just started our fourth year here, which means that we've now been here long enough to feel like the, you know, our life, the fruit of our life, is flavored by the soil here. And
yeah.
And you know, the relationships that we've created across the city, and you know, are solid. And we found a lot of really fun, like-minded people and folks who aren't so like-minded, and
right.
Just building community with all those folks. So, but we're also, I mean, it's been an incredible experience for my family. It's exactly what my family needed, to explore the myth that quantity time begets quality, and it just wasn't a reality, really a possibility of our lives in the Bay Area, the way that that we were running. And so I know my family knows me, and that's incredible.
And that, you don't feel like that would have been the same, you wouldn't have felt the same connection between you had you stayed in the San Francisco Bay?
Well, you know, I think that just the bivocational reality of my and Jackie's world, and
yeah,
and then, you know, doing some of the work that I do as well, like I'm on the road a fair amount, and then coming back home into like some of the frenetic, like necessary pace of the Bay Area probably wouldn't been so conducive for my soul, and then I think I would have shown up as a husband and as a dad. But I mean, the way that it was rolling, you know, I just think our kids were in car seats too often, and okay. I think Jackie and I were tag team parenting too often, and I think we needed this kind of tweak to reset some stuff as a family. But then, yeah. You know, beyond that, you know, I find myself in Oregon now, which is obviously so different than California in almost all ways, and. And you know, here in Bend, I find myself sitting around identity shaping conversations for this city, which is just, I'm honored to be around those tables, but I'm also like, I'm stimulated by a place like Bend. That's one of the fastest growing cities in the country where identity is up for grabs, and how a cross-shaped perspective gets to be woven into those conversations, you know? And, and then, you know, have been a part of some really incredible work happening with the migrant community here locally and statewide. And so it's just a really, it's a dynamic moment to be in this city and in this state, and we're loving it so far. So
the nature of your work, I mean, the like Bend is a peaceful place. I mean, that's one of the things that's true of Bend to some degree, is that it's a place where it seems like, cause people go there to vacation. People go there to not do. People go to literally lays on the river for hours on end. Does that have some kind of the correlative relationship to your work, that so much of what you do has to do with conflict, and that living in Bend as opposed to living in a place like the East San Francisco Bay Area, like there's more of a relief of tension, like home feels more peaceful to you?
You know, I think yes. On the one hand, yes, and there are other things that Jackie and I, like the design of who we are. There's a renewal that happens for us in the mountains, rivers, and lakes that's different than a more cosmopolitan space. And so I think I think there's something that connects us with the creator and with each other in this environment a little bit differently. That's been really helpful. But you know, it's always true that where, you know, this is a high alpine destination location, and the veneer is pretty beautiful, but it's really easy to scratch your fingernail through the veneer and actually see the pain. What's been fascinating for me is I've been in a cosmopolitan space for so long that Bend is rural America, man. I mean, this is Central Oregon is rural. This is a Republican city. This is it's a Democratic state. But it's been historically a Republican city, and you know, we're completely surrounded by agriculture and kind of that rural reality. And when there's explosive growth like is happening in Bend, there are really two forms of migration coming here. One is the wealthier white folk who are coming up from San Francisco, Los Angeles, down from Seattle. And they're here because of quality of life and really show up as consumers. Most of their work is elsewhere. And so I resonate with this. I work virtually and can easily be here to consume from what Bend is. And then the second migration, of course, is a brown migration, mostly in the form of Latinx folk who are coming here to build homes and to roof them and to landscape and this or that. And so you have those two migrations, and very, very few of us are migrating here to contribute. Most of us are migrating here to consume, and it's creating a unique
to consume or escape.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to consume. Like, I want my cake and I want to eat it too. I want to live big, huge, beautiful home in a beautiful place. I want to work from my house and never really contribute to the infrastructure of this place. I don't have to.
Right.
And so that shapes the dynamics of this city in a really unique way. One of the implications of that is there's a poorer white community here in Bend that this used to be a sleepy logging city.
Yes,
you know,
and it did.
Now they are completely outpriced. They can't afford to live here anymore. And so so you have an impacted community being the migrant community, the impoverished white community. We've got the highest per capita of homelessness in the country, believe it or not, based on size. So capita, the addiction and the veteran community is really significant here. There's resources, I think, which draws people, but right through, like if you move beyond the lazy river of the Deschutes as it bends its way through the city, there are a lot of people that are really, really hyper desperate. And so for someone like me, it's really interesting to be in a place where the injustice isn't as overt as it is in a place like the Bay Area, where I feel like it's in front of you all the time. I mean, Monument Quarter is right there, you know, in the East Bay. Whereas here it'd be easy to miss it all. You know? it'd be easy.
It's more hidden. The dichotomy is maybe a touch newer because so much of what is, peaceful, enjoyable, Disney-esque about Bend, which is why folks go to Bend for their, 3 to 7 day vacations, yeah, is newer.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And it comes, people's 7 day vacation here comes at high cost. Comes at high cost to a lot of people who have lived here for a long time, but can no longer afford to do so.
So for you, your experience of home, making a home in a place like Bend, you're still, it's, to some degree, this is a bit of a training you've done in you and in your work. You still recognize or experience home through the same filter. In other words, you recognize your home environment in the same way you experience your home environment in the same way as you experience your general world. You don't shift a gear where you're back in Bend, which you call home now, and you flip off the filter, like, out there is conflict, here is home. You're trying to, you're the same person in both places.
That's right. That's right. I mean, for me to be home means that I'm following Jesus in practical ways here, and I am not here to escape. I am here to faithfully follow Jesus with my family together. I can't separate those things, And so it would be easy for me to travel around the country and around the world into the points of conflict and pain like I do, and then come here and put my feet up and be like, okay, I'm going to bury my head in the sand trap of the country club here in Bend and pretend like the pain doesn't exist here too. Or, like yesterday, I for the last year, I've been accompanying an undocumented youth and his family through the court system. And yesterday I was in the courthouse again, with this family. And so in the last 3 weeks, I curated an immersion with US-based leaders in the borderlands between San Diego and Tijuana, exposing them to the immigration phenomenon as Tijuana is preparing for this influx of asylum seekers. Then I'm in Washington, D.C., literally sitting down with senators talking about how it is that they are committing to walk across the aisle on behalf of our country's migrants. Mm-hmm. And then I'm back here in my own city accompanying an undocumented youth and his family through the court system. So, like,
you want to live in the same, you want to be the same person in all of those scenarios.
I want to live one life. And by the way, my work with Global Immersion, its credibility is not found in how articulate I am. It's found in my practice.
Yeah.
And so a DC congressional visits are a part of my work. But the reason I have credibility there is because of the work that I'm doing in Bend to accompany my migrant sisters and brothers here.
So let's move to one of those points of conflict and pain that right now is, at least for the time being, on the national stage. As of, I think it was even yesterday, I mean, John Huckins, he's the co-founding director, yep, of Global Immersion Project, was at the border. I'll let you elaborate more on what he's up to there. And meanwhile, you have an event December 15th called the Day of Cross-Border Solidarity. Last weekend, when what became known as the caravan, the immigrant caravan, when it reached the southern border, CNN blows up and Fox blows up and MSNBC blows up and the news story starts circling around and the narrative starts kind of moving in various directions. Your filter, your view, your eyes on the southern border, when the caravan reached the southern border, what do you see? Like, how do you experience that moment? Because here I am, I was actually at an airport in San Diego waiting for my flight, and I'm watching folks engage with CNN and Fox and MSNBC in the conversations. But in the context of your work and your history, how do you see that event? How do you see those few days as people start hitting the border who have been traveling for thousands of miles? What's that moment like for you? What do you see? What's in your head? What's in your heart?
Yeah, I mean, for the last 6 years, we've been partnering with Mexican colleagues and building the relational infrastructure to help expose U.S.-based leaders to this phenomenon. And so I can't help but to view what's happening right now in any way other than through the lenses of what I've seen in Tijuana and through the lenses of my friends as they're interpreting it in the city of Tijuana. So the way that I view this is, number one, I haven't been viewing it for the last couple of days. We've been working real time with our Mexican colleagues for the past 2 months because they understand that there's going to be a huge group of these people who are going to be absorbed by their city. I mean, the Otay Mesa right there at San Ysidro, it's the most crossed border daily in the Western Hemisphere.
Yes,
so there's going to be a huge group of people who are going to be coming there. Secondly, Tijuana understands itself as a city of migrants. So you're hard pressed to find anybody in Tijuana who has been born and raised there, right? It was a sleepy agriculture village that grew in prominence because of prohibition. And so American sailors would come down to Tijuana to have their women and their boots, you know? And so that's what actually exploded Tijuana. And so then all sorts of opportunities emerged, and that's why people migrated to the city. So it's a city of migrants that on a daily basis is receiving migrants from the south and from the north. From the south, because of the unrest in southern Mexico and in Central America. And from the north, Tijuana absorbs between 300 and 600 deported men, women, and children from the United States every single day. So, you know, this Tijuana as a city that's absorbing people on the move is not a new thing for them. So I'm viewing it through all of these lenses. I'm also recognizing that Tijuana is a city that has been disempowered by their neighbors to the north, especially from a faith context, because, you know, it's the most evangelized city in the world because there's so many of our churches that go down there short-term mission trips to build homes and to do VBSs. So the churches don't do children's ministry because the next VBS will be there. Right. And we were just sitting with the city planners a few weeks ago of Tijuana, and they were helping us understand the implications on the city to our house building projects, where there's no rhyme or reason behind how any of these homes have been built. And it's creating a catastrophe in the city. They can't organize it, and they can't build the infrastructure to support the growth of the city. Right. So
because like the plans and the plans and even like sort of the goodwill acts of white evangelical churches make a mess of like city oriented plans. Like the folks who actually have like a long term investment in Tijuana have to work around these like hyper well funded but like kind of dropped on them last minute plans of groups of kids who come down and show up and say, we're going to build this thing here.
Yep. And exactly. And so we, in our mission trips, which I perpetuated as a pastor as well, you know, we go down saying, yeah, we're in relationship. We're in relationship with this organization and this church. But this organization and this church come to find out are not in relationship with the city at all. And so there's just been this haphazard growth that's very challenging for the city to build infrastructure around. And so the city itself is a remarkable experiment, and it's chaotic already, and you have all these dynamic Mexican leaders who are trying to figure out how do we build a cohesive strategy around the growth of this city.
So one of the things I'm hearing you say is when like as this moment approached for you, you weren't thinking so much about like what happens on this side of the border, San Diego and north. You're thinking these folks are going to be received into Tijuana. You're thinking through the filter of your partnerships and your colleagues, your Mexican colleagues in Tijuana, and how it's going to impact them. Can you talk like who is it when you talk about your Mexican colleagues, who is it you're working with on the other side of the border in Tijuana? What are they doing? What's your partnership look like over there?
Yeah. So we're working with faith leaders. We're working with the city planners of Tijuana. We're working with the university system. We're working with urban gardeners and urban farmers. We're working with the directors of migrant and deportee shelters. We're working with an intersectional community of influencers in Tijuana, as partners in the work of training, right? And helping US-based leaders understand what it means to become everyday peacemakers, especially as it pertains to the migrants who live in our own neighborhoods, but also helping faith leaders understand the implications of our well-intentioned short-term missions in a city like Tijuana.
Yeah.
Right? So as over 6 years, as we've been doing this work, we've been building trust. And when trust happens, so does credibility. And then we get introduced out to more and more people, more of the folks who are building a citywide strategy, you know, who are doing the research on the implications of all these things, who are like Tijuana literally might be leading the world, a city leading the world in terms of how do you absorb people on the move, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're experiencing it on a daily basis. And so these are the people that are our partners. And you're right, when I'm watching the migrant caravan come north, I'm thinking to myself, the United States is not going to have to really deal with these folks. Tijuana is. Hmm. And that's exactly what's happening right now. And so, you know, long story at a medium length, as this was happening and as we've been in relationship with them over the last couple of months, another couple of things have been going on. Number one, our Customs and Border Patrol system has begun to release people from the detention centers just north of the border to create space for these asylum seekers who are coming up from Honduras. And so that means that on a daily basis, up to 250, between 50 and 250 people a day are being released with anklets, with the computerized anklets, into the city of Tijuana. So now that creates, the majority of the Global Immersion team is in San Diego, and we're a part of a massive network, a borderland network, because San Diego and Tijuana are one gigantic city.
Yes, they are.
International line through it, right? And so so our team has been working throughout the city of San Diego to immediately enact a strategy to figure out what it means for San Diego to absorb these folk, to accompany them, to make sure that they're safe, that they have shelter, that they have food, and they have resources to get connected into their families that are spread out all over the country. So that's happening. Also, we have our government talking about these Honduran asylum seekers as dangerous invaders, rather than the traumatized families that they really are. I was just down there last Wednesday, sitting right at the border where they're waiting to get in line to be able to present their asylum case. And I will tell you that of all the asylum seekers that I've met over the past 5 years, without exception, they have a story of such horrifying trauma, the likes of which I can't even fathom, to be honest. And so like 10 times out of 10, that's the story. And as I'm sitting there on Wednesday, I'm looking around, and they're women and their children and their old men and their young men, and they're there because they believe that if they cross the border, they can present a case for asylum and at least get themselves in the space of hospitality. They can get away from the violence that they've been fleeing for the last 2,800 miles. And so our government is painting the picture of these as dangerous invaders, when they're women and children and young men and old men who are fleeing violence. And so our response from a national point of view is to militarize our border by sending troops down there with guns and gas canisters, mm-hmm. at $120 million price tag.
Yes.
Right? So I'm watching all of this happen. And at the same time, we're listening to our colleagues in Mexico say, now is the time to trust the strength of our relationship. We're building real-time strategy, and we're going to be inviting you guys into it. We're going to need you to respond to our invitations.
So what do you say to the folks who, there was the picture, and I wish I had actually the name of the photographer on hand, but there was the picture of this woman with her children that floated around the internet. I saw it, I posted it as well. Here are the folks, we'll get to this later on. We're talking about like sides of stories, but like the one narrative, the one side of the story is like, here are the people, these are the people who just hit the border. These are the people we're calling dangerous. It's this mother and her children. And then the pushback is, well, no, that's actually just like, that's just the piece of the story that we're being told by folks who aren't paying attention. But really, there are thousands of military aged men who are on the way up through. And that's the real threat. And that left-leaning, blind, media-oriented Americans are going to pay attention to this woman and her kids. But really, they're the rock-throwing 24 to 30-year-olds behind her, and that's the real problem. Like, what do you have to say to that moment there, to that kind of conflict?
Yeah, it's such a good question. I mean, I say to those people, come with me and meet these 24 to 30-year-old men. It's so easy for us in the United States to hide behind our borders, listen to convenient rhetoric, and continue to worship at our idol of safety, right? And so, like, and Justin, as a faith leader, my sense is we have discipled people into the worship of this idol of safety, which means that we will glom onto any message point that reinforces our commitment to our own safety. Right. And so I as someone who I live in Bend, I have no reason to ever go down to San Diego. I'm not in proximity to what's going on down there. And so it's easy for me to listen to the talking point. And if I worship at the idol of safety, go, yeah, we like these people, they must be dangerous, you know, or they threw some stones. And as a nonviolent practitioner, I don't necessarily condone the throwing of stones, but the throwing of stones, when you actually understand the geography of what's actually happening at the border and the three levels of walls that are right there, a stone being thrown and then it being responded to with the launching of gas canisters, which actually are lethal if they hit somebody in their head, right? I mean, it's easy for us to follow the rhetoric and the talking points of all of our media sources and go, yeah, if they're of military age, they must be here to crush us, right? Yeah. That's just simply not true. Not to mention, there's not a chance, and this is unfortunate, there's not a chance that these people are going to receive asylum. It's just the last time there was a caravan that came into Tijuana, there were 250 of them. Three were granted asylum. Three.
Wow.
So
when was that?
What's that?
When was that?
That was this spring. So when the last big caravan, you know, hype was all going on, March through May.
Yeah.
250 made it to Tijuana. Three were granted asylum, and all of them had virtually the same story. Do you know? And so, like, we're changing policy real time through executive orders and in other ways to further decrease the ability for someone to tell a viable story that would grant them asylum in our country. So we've taken away gang violence and domestic abuse as viable stories. So if that's why you're fleeing, not to mention, like, these people are fleeing the cartels, which is fueling gang violence and domestic violence and so on and so forth in Central America, like, sorry that happened to you and that you traveled 2,800 miles to get here, but you don't qualify, right?
So because before you get here, we already have decided.
Yes.
Not just on the basis of your story, but by policy. Like, as a policy, we've decided we don't actually believe your story. So as much, regardless of the truth or non-truth or untruth of your story, we've decided we don't believe your story before you arrive. Because these are the things we've, and that's a matter of policy, not a matter of conversation and engagement.
Right. And international law says that when someone seeks asylum, they're to be hosted in the country that they're seeking asylum in. And so not only have we decreased the opportunity or the talking points or the reasons for seeking asylum, now we're saying we're not going to host these asylum seekers. So we're going to defy international law and say, no, Tijuana, you need to absorb them. You need to host them while they wait in line for the next 3 weeks to 3 months to even present their asylum case, which will mean nothing to those who are listening to it.
Which brings me back to your focus as the Global Immersion Project on Tijuana instead of just on San Diego. That U.S. foreign policy or U.S. policy towards immigration was something of a secondary consideration, that you're thinking more so of, like, here's what's going to actually happen. This is what policy says that we're prepared for. Here's what's going to actually happen. Let's prepare for what's actually going to happen as opposed to what our policy is set up to deal with.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. And what's actually going to happen is that Tijuana, just like what happened with the Haitian asylum seekers when they came to Tijuana.
Exactly.
Right. Yes. So when we go down there on the 15th, one of the perspectives that we're going to learn from is a Haitian asylum seeker who now 3 years later is having to figure out what does it mean to build a future in Tijuana. Oh, and by the way, Tijuana is having to figure out how do we host a community of a couple thousand Haitians. You know, and so what's actually going to happen is we're going to have 9,000 Honduran asylum seekers in Tijuana for the most part, there's going to be a huge chunk of them who are going to have to be absorbed by the city. And so the question is, how do we serve our Mexican allies, our Tijuanan influencers, who are now having to do the hard work of accompanying these folk, because our country is not going to let them come into, you know, across the border.
Right.
So if we're going to change policy that Tijuana has to host them, what if we didn't invest $120 million in militarizing our border? What if we took that $120 million and put it in the hands of the Tijuanan organizers, who have to figure out right now how to deal with a sports complex built for 2,300 people that now houses over 5,000 people, and there are no bathrooms or toilet paper or soap or hot water or food, right? That's a humanitarian crisis that we as people of faith, and despite nationality, we as people of faith who claim to follow a cross-wearing God had better figure out what it means to love beyond boundaries and borders right now, and beyond documentation statuses and beyond policy, because people are going to die of very curable things because they are literally walking in sewage, right? We have to figure, not to mention Tijuana, as I said, is absorbing between 300 and 600 deported people a day from our country. Right. So what does it mean? What does binational solidarity look like right now? The only people that can help us understand what binational solidarity looks like are our Tijuanan friends, who are saying this is exactly where we need you.
Because they're the folks who are actually dealing with it in real time with real people and real stories and actual bodies versus looking at a situation either through the filter of a television screen or even through the filter of their television screen after like accommodating a particular political narrative that then sort of informs which television screen and what's going to be on the TV screen. That these are people who are dealing with who's actually there and what's actually going on, which is what the Global Immersion Project is trying to get to, is let's talk to the people in the place. Real quickly, if not quickly because it doesn't matter, but I'd rather you talk more in terms of, like, you know, the things you do as opposed to the sort of the grand narrative. But the Global Immersion Project started, we're going on a decade or more now?
Yeah, eight years.
And if you were to explain to someone, say, hey, so you know, I saw a T-shirt, I saw a hat, Global Immersion Project, I listened to this podcast, this came up, what is it you do? What is this thing called the Global Immersion Project?
Yeah, put very bluntly, we're a peacemaking training organization that is connecting people of faith to the points of pain in the world in restorative ways. And so every single thing that we do raises our capacity to stand on a restorative theology and then practice it in a way that actually joins God in remaking the world, wherever we live, work, and play. And so we talk about everyday peacemaking because we recognize that peacemaking is a core expression of Christian faithfulness, that it isn't for the professionals and the humanitarians. It is a way of life that we've all been invited into, and it looks like something in our neighborhoods, in our cities, in our country, and in our world. So in mundane and profound ways, we're helping to people pay attention to the tools that are already in their hands and then teaching them how to use them restoratively wherever they live, work, and play.
So you work alongside and predominantly, I don't know predominantly, but you work alongside churches, church leaders, church people. You yourself, which is how you and I met, you worked as a pastor. Can you talk about, in this context, can you talk about your experience of working with churches? And I ask because the it can be difficult for someone who is not a churchgoer to think that there might be anything remotely like hope for church people to enter into spaces of conflict without already picking sides and deciding how this thing's going to play out. Because we're talking about, you know, we can get to this a little bit more as you go along. Like, are these predominantly white evangelical folks? Are these predominantly folks who are coming from the group of folks who supported the Trump presidency, or like the 60 some odd or 70% of people who got behind a senatorial candidate in Mississippi who like championed the Confederacy and said that she would actually go to, like, publicly said that she would attend a hanging, like, these, like, are these the folks you're showing up to partner with you? And if they are, why would you have hope that there is some sort of like balm in and among this group of people. Talk about your experience with the church in the context of like this moment in time when white evangelical Christianity seems to be on one, I'm not even gonna call it the wrong side, but on one dominant side of racial, political, and sociopolitical conflict.
I think my empathy keeps growing. Here's what I would say. I would say that I would echo what I think we see, what we read and see consistently in the New Testament, and that by your fruit, you will be identified. You will be known as a part of the Jesus movement. And and when I see right now in American evangelicalism, a lot of line drawing around this concept of neighbor that seems really similar to what we see happening in Luke chapter 10, right? And there is a fierce defining and a narrow defining of who my neighbor is, because we as white evangelicals want to be really clear whom we're responsible for and whom we're not responsible for. Mm. And
that's good.
And I think that right now in this particular moment, if we are responding, if we are responding with fear, if we are responding with judgment, or if we are responding with apathy and indifference to what's happening at the border, that's called fruit. And I think we need to sniff that fruit and wonder if it actually carries the aroma of Jesus or not. Sure. And so from my experience, the people who are we get to do a lot of work within evangelical spaces, and I we're grateful for those invitations, because every time we're there, Justin, and every time we tell the story of a God whose mission is restoration, and of a Jesus who says, "I am making all things new here and now," and help people understand that we are how Jesus is making all things new here and now. The lean-in factor in these conservative evangelical settings is remarkable. Hmm. We love it's just so great. I would say the people who are engaging in this moment are people who have their roots in American evangelicalism and have become disillusioned by it, because they recognize that it doesn't produce what it promises. That the Jesus that they were trained to follow is a Jesus who encourages them to accumulate power, abundance, and safety, and that just doesn't match with what they see of the Jesus in the scriptures. And so the people who are joining us in our work, and I think the folk that we're being a part of training more so than ever before, are people who are disillusioned by what they feel is a bill of goods that's been sold to them. They're interested in exploring a Jesus who puts on display what a cross-wearing, enemy-loving, others-embracing God looks like, and are actually willing to take some steps beyond the incubators of safety toward people who are not like them, and they're finding themselves found and formed by God as they do. Right? And so mostly dominant culture, I would say, evangelical in their orientation, waking up to a hopeful alternative to so much of what they'd been offered in their upbringing.
Which is part of why what you do, and it's the way it's described at the site, which is it's globalimmerse.org. You talk about theological training. You actually, part of what you do is actually to address. Not, if I'm understanding this correctly, you're not just doing some sort of broad, let's understand theology as theology. You're addressing the theological considerations of human relationships across borders or across ideological differences.
Absolutely.
The theological consideration is part of what I want to get to, and we're going to get to this sort of the practice of the lexicon in a few moments here, but when you're talking about theology, like your understanding of theology, like maybe needed to shift. And I want you to talk about the word theology. Talk about what theology is for you in this context, because earlier you were talking about safety and the idol of safety. And part of where that comes from, and you and I share a narrative here, as like we're roughly the same age. We're those guys. We're like the straight white Christian males. Yeah. And the part of what was sold to me and sold to you was the narrative of saved. It was the saved narrative. And so it shouldn't come as a shock that safety becomes an idol in a theological framework in which being saved is the freaking goal. Like, if, like, once you're saved, you're done. So if I'm saved, why then do I have to deal with all this conflict in the world? That doesn't make me feel safe. So can you talk about theology in maybe more of a kind of a boots on the ground way, which seems to be more your understanding of theology now, that like there was this, hey, I'm saved thing, and which leads to the idolatry of safety. How has that changed for you? Like, what does theology mean for you? How is it still important? Like, and maybe not is it so important, but like, in what way is theology important for you now?
Absolutely. Man, what a great question, Jess. I believe wholeheartedly that we're all theologians, and because there are thoughts about who God is that shape who I think I am and also shape who I think others are. And those thoughts about who God is, who I am, and who others are inform how I behave, inform how I show up on the planet. And so not only are we all theologians, but we're practicing theologians. I don't know theology that isn't, I know good teaching that isn't lived out, but theology, like our core theological undertones or foundation, it shows up in our life. It just simply. And so
the theology doesn't so much live in your head as it lives in your feet. It lives in your hands. It lives in your pocketbook. Right. It lives on your calendar. That's where your theology actually is.
Absolutely. It shows up in every decision that is made in my day. It shows up in my value systems. It shows up in what I expose my kids to and what I try to shield them from. Mm. My theology shows up in how I'm a neighbor. It shows up in how I spend my spare time. You know, I mean, we all live out our theological core every single day. And so if we're actually going to take peacemaking seriously, we have to audit our theology and wonder, is there space in my theology for an expression of Christian faithfulness that looks like peacemaking? Hmm. And I would argue that the theology that I was groomed in and that I inherited pointed to a God who was white, violent, and male. And so... Hmm. So I like, which is really convenient for someone who looks like me as,
yeah.
Because if God looks like me, then God is like the power source and the broker of power and sits enthroned in power. And so if God is white, violent, and male, then God probably endorses my accumulation and protection of wealth, abundance, power, and safety. And it keeps me seated in the seat of power. So I can remain indifferent to all that's going on in the world. Because I think that this white male violent God actually endorses my accumulation of godliness made real in abundance, power, and safety. And then I just incubate inside of that and I work with people who are just like me. Right. And I think some of this God as violent, I mean, that's one of the things that theologically we have to dismantle like crazy if we're going to take peacemaking seriously. But we've been discipled through our Sunday school theology that God is violent. We sing these songs like Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho, and we're like literally singing a song about genocide and like celebrating this stuff. And it reinforces that God is exclusively focused on a particular group of people to the exclusion of other people. Right. And so a theology that God looks like me leads me to believe that God is hyper concerned with people who look like me to the exclusion of people who don't look like me. So if God endorses genocide in the Hebrew scriptures, at the bare minimum, I can exclude them from my community and still be faithful.
Strong. Right? So that's really good.
Begins to flesh out. And so I've had to go through an entire process of dismantling this theology of God is violent, God is male, God is white, God is none of these things, you know? And how do I know that? Because I've begun to shape my theology not through a chronological from the garden to the new city, but the start point of my theology is the cross. And where I see and understand the cross as a violent act, but not a violent act initiated by God. It's a restorative act of unbelievably sacrificial powerlessness, right? And so then I understand all of the rest of the story through the lenses of the cross. And so if the cross, you know, and Paul writes about this all the time, but like Colossians 1, it was through the blood of Jesus at the cross that all things are reconciled to God, right? You see it again in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, talking about the reconciliation that has been accomplished because of the cross. And so if reconciliation, restoration is the point of the cross, that's an act of love, not an act of violence.
Yes.
That portrays God as a redemptive, extravagantly loving, pursuing God who will stop at nothing, including putting on flesh and entering into the brokenness and moving toward the pain and doing so not punitively, but restoratively. If that's who God is, and if restoration is the mission of that God, then I, because of the cross and the empty tomb, am not only the reconciled beloved, I'm a beloved reconciler. My work on the planet is to join God in remaking the world and ushering in the new world that God is making, right? And so I can't have a theology oriented around a warrior God and then have peacemaking as a habit. That just doesn't make sense. If my theology is around a warrior God, it's going to show up in the way that I talk about these migrants who are at the border. It's going to show up in the way that I celebrate militarism in the world. It's going to show up in the way that I behave toward Muslims. It's going to show up in my disposition toward the Black community, my indifference toward the indigenous community. But if I understand God through the lenses of Jesus as a cross-wearing, others-oriented, enemy-loving God, then that shapes how I think about what's happening at the border right now. That shapes what I think is happening in my city and what I think how I think God is restoratively at work and how I can join in that. It shapes how I think about Muslims. It shapes how I show up in social media in offering a different perspective than this fear-based crazy that is not the best expression of our faith. I think it's far from it.
I want to wrap it up with it's a practice I do with a lot of our guests, this sort of practice of lexicon. That there are words that you use that are important or more central to your work that like I would recognize as a word, but will have a different shape, a different form that, as you know, previous guests will talk about, Jonathan Merritt talks about the dictionary isn't so much a collection of words as they are defined in the cosmos. It's actually a collection of words as they're used, that a word is actually fleshed out, that the definition of a word is fleshed out by use over time. And so what I'd love to do is throw a few words at you that'll come, they're part of your world, the words that you use, and have you vamp on them. So I'll just put a word on the table. The first thing I want to, the first element of this though, I want to set up a little bit, because it's actually not a word. It's a short collection of words that gets used as kind of like a word. It's sort of like a showstopper type word in conversation about conflict. And I'll set it up with this. I don't know if you know who Sarah Kendzior is, but she's this fantastic journalist who wrote a book called A View from. And I'll edit this out. It is Sarah Kendzior. I'm going to look it up right now. Do you know who I'm talking about when I talk about Sarah Kendzior? Man. She's fantastic. The View from a Flyover State, I think is the name of the book. Okay. So what I want to do is I want to set it up with this this quote from Sarah Kendzior, she's a journalist and she's the author of a book called The View from Flyover Country. And she talks about like the need to understand like actual human story in moments of cultural crisis. And she starts writing this book again around the run up to the election of Donald Trump and then shortly thereafter. And she says, since the 2000 elections, pundits have been proclaiming that there are, quote, two Americas, red and blue. And then she says, this has never truly been the case. There are dozens of red Americas within extreme variations in demographics and values, and dozens of blue Americas as well. There are endless variations of, quote, America in St. Louis alone, which leads me to this quote and the sort of thing that gets floated around. Like it's like a word that gets dropped in the middle of conversations about conflict and about sociopolitical difference. There are two sides to every story. This phrase, there are two sides to every story. It's a phrase that like, this is what I put on the table to say, let's stop talking about this because you have your perspective and I have mine. There are two sides to every story. Jer, are there two sides to every story? And if that, even if that is the case, are they equal just because we have them? Talk about there are two sides to every story.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'll hit it brief. I mean, I think there are two sides. I think there are multiple sides to every story. And I think a core practice of a peacemaker is someone who can not only listen long to understand what the other side of the story is, but it can actually hold it in tension with my own side of the story. And so I think there are multiple sides of the story. I'll place that next to the fact that I believe wholeheartedly that peacemakers are pro-human. We're pro-people, and we value people's perspectives and understand that they've been shaped in various ways through mentors and teaching and media and whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But if a perspective is unkind, if it's racist, if it's dehumanizing, I can hold that perspective and understand that that's shaped, you know, that that's shaping you. But I don't need to remain neutral in that. You know, I don't need to sit and go, oh, okay, like that's your perspective or that's your side of the story. If there's hatred, racism, bigotry, xenophobia, judgment, opinionated critique, then I actually need to I need to challenge that. I need to take that on. Now, I need to be open that that stuff informs my perspective as well. But I think, yes, there are two sides to every story. But I don't think we just need to absorb it and then dance. I think we need to figure out what it means in a civil way to actually explore and critique. And for me, it means offering my own perspective or my own side of the story and allowing it to be critiqued as well.
Talk about peace. When you say the word peace, what is it you're after? What do you mean when you say peace?
Yeah. When I talk about peace, I'm talking about the holistic repair of severed relationships. Peace is not a big, huge theory. Peace is a relational reality. And you know, the image that comes to my mind is the Japanese art form called kintsugi. And in kintsugi art, a vessel is broken and it's put back together, but it's not put back together in a way that hides the cracks or the scars. As a matter of fact, it's put back together in a way that the scars are healed in solid gold. And what happens there is that the vessel is not like it was before. It's actually stronger and more beautiful than before it was broken. And where the scars are not so much a reminder of the break, but a reminder of the restoration that has taken place. Hmm. And so that's the image that's in my mind when I think about peace. And therefore, peacemaking is this joining with God and others in putting back what's been broken, such that the relationship is stronger and more beautiful than before it was broken.
Human. What does it mean to be human?
Oh, it means that we feel. It means that we're to be fully human requires that I am in relationship with humans who are not like me. I lack in my own humanity. I think I have a schizophrenic, myopic humanity if I am not in relationship with people who are not like me. And so my humanity is found only in diverse relationships.
Which leads to this last one I'd like you to vamp on for a few minutes and then we'll wrap things up. Talk about community. What's it mean to be in community? What is a community?
Yeah, community, from my view, it's not an end. Community is a means to an end, and that end is a remade world, I think. And so what my view on human relationships is that we've been put together to co-create with one another, not just to feel good side by side. And so there's broken stuff all around us, and there's beauty to be created and spoken into the world. And so the point of community, I think, is to put on display the creative, restorative nature of who God is. We get to remake the world together. And so community is a means toward that end.
Jared, thanks for your time. Appreciate it quite a bit. If someone wanted to between now and, cause I'm going to get this up relatively soon. If someone wanted to actually engage with you on December 15th, what does that look like? Where do I go? How do we pull that off?
Yeah, right. Globalimmerse.org features the landing page and the registration for this event. It's going to be a one-day event that is going. We're literally going to hike supplies across the border together. We're going to sit and listen to perspectives from the Central American asylum seekers, Haitian asylum seekers, Tijuana influencers who are doing the work. We're going to be exposed to what's going on over there. Then we're going to join in this Posada, which is a Catholic Mexican liturgy that really commemorates the journey of the Holy Family as they sought refuge and were continuously denied it. And that's going to be a bi-national event happening on both sides of the border simultaneously, share a bunch of tables and a big, huge meal with these asylum seekers, and then we'll do some direct service and then some strategy building for solidarity from afar. So it's going to be a remarkable day on invitation by our Mexican colleagues, and we urge you to show up. Right now we've got nearly 100 people from 23 different states who are coming to be a part of that day. So globalimmerse.org, the link will be involved in whatever follow-up happens here, and spots are limited, so get in it quick.
Fantastic. Jared, seriously, thanks for your time.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks, Justin.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the At Sea podcast. Once again, if you'd like to follow up with JAIR, the Global Immersion Project, or anything they're up to, you can go to globalimmerse.org, including information about the December 15th Day of Cross-Border Solidarity. If you'd like to support the work of this podcast, you can visit us at patreon.com/Justin McRoberts, or just go to patreon.com, patreon.com, and search my name, Justin McRoberts. We'd love to have you on the team. Until next time.